In my lifetime, I've seen politicians lambasted for flip-flopping. And you see teens on the alert for hypocrisy, but the truth is, opinions change. We take in new information and we are open to new opinions. So one place where that has occurred in my life is on AIPAC. In the 90s, and not long before I got here, during that decade and a half to two decades, I was very sour on the America-Israel Political Affairs Committee, understanding it to be at the root of a lot of the calcified dialogue on Israel in America. We lived in an era, to my experience, of Israel right or wrong, and I believed, perhaps correctly, perhaps erroneously, that AIPAC was a cause of that. So I've had the delight in the past decade of being here and attending our annual AIPAC dinner, and through the auspices of people like Stephen Rosen and Larry Leibovitz, we have had some speakers that were really phenomenally nuanced and subtle. I remember one Dutch scholar on Iran going way off what I believed to be the pro-Israel message and saying that Iran was much less likely to hurt Israel than it was to implode. And I thought, no, you're not supposed to undersell the danger of Iran. So I'm grateful. I know that every year Stephen Rosen asks for a more, I don't know, scholarly is the right word, but balanced accounting rather than sort of the propagandistic selling Israel. We don't need to be sold, he tells them. We just need to learn. So after a decade or so, I thought I'd give AIPAC take the next step in the relationship, which was I attended the AIPAC Rabbinic Symposium Tuesday, Wednesday in D.C. And I must admit that my experience is colored by having a little free time in D.C., one of my favorite cities, to attend the to visit the African American History Museum and to visit some restaurants, African restaurants that I love, to just walk a great walking city. And that AIPAC events are very swanky. Nonetheless, some really incredible information came out of that. So it was a plenary. There was an evening speaker, which was mediocre. It was about Israel's space program. A plenary breakfast, four breakout sessions, including a plenary lunch. So there was a lot of information about the upcoming election in Israel, the upcoming election in America. One of the breakouts was with Dennis Ross, who's been the ambassador or part of the American Embassy in Jerusalem for roughly two decades. Incredibly knowledgeable. I got to meet a hero of mine, Yair Rosenberg, a writer for Tablet. I don't know if anyone's ever read his stuff under his byline. He's a phenomenal writer on Israel and a lot of Jewish things. A comically mediocre speaker, kind of mumbled and spoke very fast, and he knew it. But really an incredible speaker. He wrote recently in the Washington Post about philo-Semitism being just the flip of the coin of anti-Semitism, which I've thought about for a long time. And he spoke in that breakout about the relationship between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism, which I think he confirmed for me much more than I was willing to admit. In short, he suggested that it's possible to be an anti-Zionist philosophically without being an anti-Semite, but it's pretty rare. And a lot of anti-Zionist, so to speak, organizations don't ask the follow-up questions of, you know, were the state of Israel to be eliminated, how would you protect Jews? The idea being that people who are anti-Semitic, or people, you know, on the far right, you have people who are very much in favor of Israel, but not in favor of particular Jews, so they love half the Jewish population that's in Israel. And on the left, you have people who are opposed to Israel, but, you know, have comfortable with religious pluralism in America, which means they're opposed to half of all the Jews in the world. Just depends on which half. So it was a wealth of incredibly rich information, some of which I want to share with you. Also, it brought to mind how the president has declined taking his intelligence briefings on a regular basis. And I've always thought, well, can I take them? I mean, of all the cool things about being president, to me, that's pretty high up to know every secret in America. every morning? I thought that would be like so cool. That and, you know, having your own chef, your own driver, those also sound nice. What? No sleep, right? No sleep. There's a trade-off, right? I never understand how they make decisions on 4 to 6 hours. You know, vital decisions like whether to assassinate Osama bin Laden on 4 hours of sleep. Right? But I didn't attend the sessions on Iran or BDS, which I think would have been much more unequivocal and one-sided, but the sessions I attended were fascinating. And of course, you know, AIPAC is an organization that exists at a very high tier, so they were all flawless as well. But I tried to kind of think about Israel and our relationship to Israel, both through AIPAC and aside from AIPAC, through the Parsha. So since the reform of the 19th century and perchance beforehand, there's been always, I think, a tension between Judaism as a universalist tradition and Judaism as a particularist tradition. I'm not speaking on my own personal belief, but my opinion is that it's very hard to understand Judaism as super universalist. It's largely very particularist. There are a few images we have of caring for the widow, the stranger, and the orphan, in this parsha, for example, of establishing charitable funds, but those largely serve the internal community, where I'll get. So this sort of theme, the Zionist theme, as Adam and a few others of us are exploring Sundays at 10, among other themes of Jewish folklore and mythology, is a constant. Right? I mean, I think it's at their peril that the Palestinians and other anti-Zionists, whether they're truly anti-Zionist or just using that as a masquerade for anti-Semitism, deny our long and historic and profound connection to the land. This is, to quote, I think, 5 different verses in the Parsha, the place where God establishes God's name. That prior to the settlement of the land, human beings, Jews per se, or Israelites really, could make sacrifices to God, could obey and worship God in any place or almost any place, but once ingrained in the land, once settling the land, it's Jerusalem, it's Zion, it's the Mount of Zion, and we're enjoined also to destroy all other previous worship sites, whether our own or the native inhabitants, the mountains, the hills, the trees, the altars, the pillars, the posts, and the images. There is an imagery in this parsha and throughout, especially Numbers and Deuteronomy, of conquest, of this being a land that we will hold, I want to say ruthlessly, but not in the sense of cruelly, but in the sense of without remorse. This is in an absolute sense that this is the land we will host. And a sense, perhaps Deuteronomy is already projecting or even retrojecting the idea of the monarchy, of the Davidic monarchy, which, as I've talked to a Bible scholar recently, is the first clearly attested evidence we have from Bible in an archaeological record that there was a house of David, if not a David himself. So in this parasha, chapter 17, it says, you will surely have a king. In tension with the establishment of the kingship under Saul, where there's Samuel says, you don't want to do this. It's a bad idea. But Deuteronomy already says, this is going to happen. And Rabbeinu Bachya, writing in the medieval period in the Iberian Peninsula, says the plain meaning of the Torah says that you'll have a formal king at some point in the future. It's sort of an inevitable outcome of settlement. So the imagery of settlement and nationalism and people in land, I don't mean nationalism in the dangerous sense, I mean in the barest sense of a nation, a constructed nation by ethnicity, religion, history, culture, living in a specific place, is already embedded in Torah. It's something we'll have to contend with, whether we want to be Zionists, universalists, particularists, nationalists, whether we have misgivings about the Zionist project or about the Netanyahu government. Parenthetically, I get asked that it's taken note that I don't speak about Israel much. certainly in my first few years, it was out of fear of alienating people. You know, Israel especially, and politics in general, can alienate a swath of the congregation. And in the first 2 years I was here, I was mostly concerned about getting another contract. But once I did, I started speaking more freely. But the truth is, it's not just fear. It's that my feelings on Israel are extremely complex, and I think as they ought to be. It's, as my wife pointed out last year we were there, it's not Greenpeace. The founder of Greenpeace recently died. It's not a cause. It's a country with a diversity of peoples, religions, geography, topography, culture. You would never have a single unequivocal feeling about Tennessee. Why would you have a simple unequivocal feeling about any country, but all the more so one you don't live in? And that doesn't lend itself to public speaking. You know, it's certainly nice in small conversations to talk about the difficulties of Israel, that it struggles. Just Jews among Jews struggle, never mind Jews and Arabs. There's so much tension just between Eastern and Western Jews, religious and secular Jews, different people in the religious communities. Why would it be simple? And I think what I like about AIPAC, which I didn't like for a long time, but now I have come to see the reasoning behind, they're not about any particular Jew or any particular Israeli or one particular administration here or there. They're about the bridge between America and Israel almost exclusively. And what I found fascinating, both in sessions here, but more so in DC, in this era of hyper-partisanship in America, trips to Israel by AIPAC are one of the rare times Republicans and Democrats go in proportion to their presence in Congress, and sometimes sit together on a bus. I think they said there are three issues where this happens, and it's maybe support for veterans, Israel, and one other thing. So I don't know, I was really moved. And this, you know, again, to return to the question of particularism or particularist nationalism versus universalism and the tension, I think, that has always existed, but I think we are solidly a particularist community. And I've pointed this out in a story at my 10th high school reunion. I connected with someone because he had recently been to Ireland. Not because he cared about Judaism, but because he had connected with his heritage and I was in the process of connecting with mine. That allowed us to connect. Particularism isn't always a problem, and tribalism can work out quite nicely. I can go into that at a separate time. So I was talking with Alan Solomon after Minyan, and there's this, Re'eh has a lot of economics in it. The Shemitah, remittance of debt, and the statement that there should be no needy among you, yet verses later, there will always be needy people among you. I mean, this incredible paradox, which the Talmud picks up on. So Rav Yehuda said in Rav's name that what this paradox indicates is that your needy should take precedence over any other community, meaning particularism. But he also said in the exact same oral tradition that if you strictly observe this, you'll be brought to poverty. And they understood the paradox. And that's, I guess, where I'm going is this sort of what I would call benign tribalism. What I would view in the good times in the Peace Corps, you don't see it much in the Sahel now because of competition for resources, but in my town where I lived, there were four major tribes, and they didn't hate each other, they just didn't take time to care. You drink your beer, I drink my beer, you're taller and darker, I'm shorter, squat and light, we have this food, oh, your food is disgusting, but you enjoy it. There was no sense that what the other was doing was essentially or ontologically wrong. It was just different and not my choice. So we have this, we don't use the word very carefully. First of all, Zion in modern Hebrew is not a polite word. It's Zion. But also, it's not about the state. Zion was really just the mount where Jerusalem was. So that is the epicenter of our longing. And Maimonides, in his Guide for the Perplexed, talks about why Zion becomes the center, the epicenter of the longing. And it's because the worldly nations didn't fortify this place or wage war on it because it was the place Torah came from. They didn't vandalize it, and no tribe could make it part of their territory. It was to quote another source, basically Ottawa or DC. It was extraterritorial capital. It was not part of any particular province or tribe or state. Maimonides' comment that no one attacked or vandalized it, maybe he meant up until the period of its settling, but it was certainly razed quite a few unfortunate times. I'm not suggesting international condominium over Jerusalem as the solution to the Jerusalem problem, but I'm suggesting that there are levels in life. You know, I think about the way we learn experiences of deepening in one's life. So you might start with a yoga practice. I'm thinking of myself. And then go inward to a study practice. So you've got the physical, the mental, then you might go to the psychological and a deepening level, and then the spiritual. I think a lot of, in fact, the Kabbalah talks about four levels of existence and understanding. I think so, working outward in, I think what Maimonides is hinting at, in this other source later, these places exist on four realities or several realities at once. There's the physical space of Israel, but then there's the affective space, there's the intellectual space, and then there's the deeper spiritual space. Now, what our tradition calls the Jerusalem on high. And that's the struggle. You know, there are rabbis, there's a debate, it's not an interesting debate, but there's a debate over whether you should say Hallel on Israel Independence Day, Yom HaAtzma'ut, and my opinion is no. Hallel is explicitly a religious expression, and Yom HaAtzma'ut is mostly a political, pragmatic political expression. If you sanctify political experience, you're doing a lot of danger. You're stepping into, to me, I'm willing to debate this, very murky and dangerous waters, because it's much harder to compromise on religion than it is on a hill. You know, if you see Gush Etzion as part of God's manifest destiny to you, it's going to be much harder to cede it to another people. Or even to build a military radio tower on it. And, you know, again, I'm using the temple and Jerusalem as a synecdoche for all of Zion and Israel. But that temple, Sforno, an Italian commentator, I think 16th century, says, is also called the Beit Olamim, the eternal house. Again, I think talking and drawing us down to the deeper levels. And there are Hasidic and ultra-religious groups that understand this. The question of political boundaries or political accommodation or relationships or war over the land of Israel is not the same as the religious issue. They might overlap, but they're not coexistent. So, in a beautiful verse in the parsha this week, we're told, Ki am kadosh ata, Adonai Elohecha, v'cha v'cha Adonai lihyot lo la'am segula, mikol hamim, asher al pnei adama. You are a holy people to God your God. And through you, God has chosen you to be a treasured people among all the nations that are on the face of the earth. Without going into the question of chosenness to refer to Bernard, I do love that image. I can't let go of it. That if all of your children thought they were the chosen child, you would have been a good, very good parent. Right? But this idea of the Am Kadosh, the Am Segula, the treasured people, the sacred people, the people set aside, again, in the sort of benign tribalism that I would advocate, doesn't have to be a chauvinism or a superiority. It has to be, it can be, and maybe even has to be, a looking inward. That we have to take, this is Dennis Ross said this really beautifully, you kind of have to take yourself to account before you can take the other party to account. You know, I forget who the other, he's written a book with someone, and they're both basically partly flogging their book, but partly teaching. And they talked about, you know, we keep trying to do the home run between Israel-Palestine and in the Middle East peace process, and we need to start making some singles and maybe some doubles. He said, you know, the Israelis should commit to not building new settlements. I forget, he made a comment to stabilizing Gaza. The Palestinians, they can make sort of these simple commitments that show good faith. And I think that's incredibly important. And he also analyzed the Palestinian problem in an incredible, astute way. He said that their whole culture, the political culture, is based on resistance. Which is true. And they started as a resistance, as did Zionism to an extent, right? And you can become very entrenched in resistance to your own detriment. But I'm not, again, I don't want to point fingers at the other side, but so some 5 years ago, I said we both need to apologize for our mistakes. And we both need to make tshuva, good time to talk about tshuva, and we both need to try to hit a lot of singles and doubles and stop swinging for the fences, but build trust and good faith. And I can't remember all the examples they gave, but and it's in a book that I gave to the library. But you know, the Baal Shem Tov says this is Am Kadosh thing, is what it's indicating is God gives physical form to the spiritual, and the Jew makes spiritual the physical. And so in contradistinction to saying Hallel on Yom HaAtzmaut, on Israel Independence Day, maybe we also need to think of stepping from the land itself and the political nation state to a spiritual level of existing in the human community and existing as a light unto nations and using our newfound statehood, really still newfound, still a lot to iron out, as a way of spiritual deepening for the whole world. And that will probably mean compromise, and it will probably mean that the best is the enemy of the good, to quote Voltaire. And everyone's going to need to struggle and sacrifice and make compromise. And the hallmark of a good compromise, I wish Ted was here, Ted is here, is that everyone's a little unhappy. You know? I'm sorry. It's not an easy issue. And I was pleasantly surprised more and more to realize AIPAC doesn't think it's an easy issue. They just want America to be part of the issue. And ideally, eventually part of the solution, but that doesn't mean that it's a tub thumper, that it's Israel right or wrong. It's deeply, deeply complex, frustrating, and distressing, and it probably ought to be. If you don't take it, if you don't see it as something about which you are ambivalent and struggle with, you're not taking it seriously enough.